General Menezes, Reel 14. We were talking about the situation in East and West Pakistan and the political problems that were arising between the two in the early 70s, about 1971. If you'd like to continue.
Yes, so in March 71, the writing was on the wall that some problems were occurring in what was then East Pakistan as a result of Mujibur Rahman, who had been elected and who should have been the Prime Minister of the whole of Pakistan, but the West Pakistanis would not have a Bengali from East Pakistan as their Prime Minister. So as a result, there was a so-called insurrection in East Pakistan, which the West Pakistanis then began putting down by moving troops and formations to East Pakistan to suppress these so-called insurgents. It was not an insurgency from that point of view. It was the verdict of democracy, which was not being heeded by the West Pakistanis. So massacres had started in East Pakistan, and the people who were being suppressed began fleeing into India. So at that point of time, 11 million East Pakistanis had fled into India. Mrs. Gandhi had gone to the UN, but nobody was paying any heed. And it was then argued that it was by the West that it was an internal situation for Pakistan to sort out. When they were sorting it out by force and just a greater influx of refugees into India, India could not support. It already has a large population. India could not support such a large population of 11 million extra. So as a result, we knew something was going to happen. So in Western Command, a telephone battle was held as to this situation that was developing.
Now, what do you remember of that? You were there as commander of 14th Infantry Division.
Yes, as to what role my division would play.
Can you tell us about the telephone battle and how it went? Because it's fascinating.
Well, a telephone battle is the same way as we also did at Staff College, in the sense that you have so-called appointment holders. I was a GOC for division in the Staff College telephone battle. And then you have an enemy. So the same situation here. I, as GOC 14th Division, would have, shall we say, for purposes of argument, another brigadier as my enemy. So he would be the Pakistani. I would be told what the Pakistanis were doing, and I would then have to do what say what I was proposed to do.
Now, and how did it go? What do you remember what actually happened, if you see what I mean, in the telephone battle?
Well, we were doing the telephone battle not for East Pakistan, but for West Pakistan. I mean, because the events that were taking place, the suppression was taking place in East Pakistan, but the information was that Pakistan would, shall we say, react in the West also, which they did. But the point is that when they began flying in troops to suppress the East Pakistanis, India then denied Indian airspace to the Pakistani aircraft, because they said they could not, from the human rights point of view, connive with the fact that troops were moved through Indian airspace to suppress, shall we say, East Pakistan, because East Pakistan had a fair number of Hindus also, and all of them were fleeing to India. West Pakistan, the Hindus had been driven out in 1947. So, insofar as the West is concerned, West Pakistan is concerned, we knew some kind of preemptive action would be taken at some point of time, depending on the extent of the opposition to the West Pakistani forces in East Pakistan. So we learned, I would be, shall we say, attacking, and a fellow Indian Army brigadier would be the so-called Pakistani enemy. So similarly, I would be the enemy for one of our own officers who who was, shall we say, defending. So we were changing roles from the point of view of attack and defense, so that different viewpoints were illuminated in terms of the prospective operational situation. That briefly is a nutshell what happened in the telephone battle.
So what was your had the situation blown up before, had the war hadn't started before you went to the HQ of First Corps, had it?
No, the war was impending. It was now decided that HQ 1 Corps would be the strike corps. It had been the so-called strike corps even in 65, but it got bogged down. But then it was argued that it did not have a chief of staff. In the headquarters commanded by Lieutenant General, you normally have a chief of staff in the rank of Major General. It's an American concept adopted later by the British also. So Headquarters 1 Corps did not have a chief of staff. So I was the first chief of staff who was posted to Headquarters 1 Corps.
Now, could you just describe for us in a nutshell what your role as chief of staff was?
So I arrived one day. Overnight, I was asked to report and was told that, shall we say, hostilities were imminent from the intelligence point of view, that Pakistan was about to do something. The corps commander who was there, he got his orders for retirement already. So that pattern of retirement was to continue. So he invited me to dinner as soon as I arrived. I arrived in the evening, he invited me to dinner that night, and he said he was leaving the next morning on retirement. So I immediately became officiating corps commander as well, till such time as the new corps commander arrived. Now the new corps commander was at that point of time the director of military operations in Delhi, and I was told that I'd possibly have to officiate for 2 months as corps commander, because he would be busy debriefing Bengali, that is the East Pakistani officers who were defecting to India. For example, the first defection was a Major Manzoor, who was a brigade commander in the Pakistani army. He crossed over to India once the suppression of the Pakistanis had commenced in East Pakistan, So we had situations where the East Pakistani officers of the Pakistani army were defecting to India, and they had to be debriefed in the operational context. So my new corps commander would not be available for 2 months, because it's considered important that since he was the prospective corps commander, that he should personally debrief these people from West Pakistan who were defecting to India, having been part of the Pakistani army, because they were East Pakistanis. And so to that extent, they were bringing valuable information across. So I officiated as corps commander for 2 months. He eventually only reported as soon as the hostilities were actually imminent.
Now, how was it acting as corps commander? How was your, I mean, that's a real, really high level of command you were acting as there.
No, apart from visiting the formations that we would be taking part in the war, I had to ensure what happened was that all of a sudden intelligence was received that Pakistan was going to launch their preemptive attack at Pathankot. So I was again moved overnight with the tactical headquarters to Pathankot to ensure that the preemptive attack was repulsed, and I would take command of the situation till such time as the corps commander arrived, and in the meantime deploy the formations that came. Formations from places like Secunderabad and Jhansi and all had to be moved up. That all would take time. and I would be there with my core headquarters to take command as soon as they arrived and deploy them in a defensive posture. And the corps commander would come as soon as he'd finished all these debriefings.
How do you spell Pathankot?
P-A-T-H-A-N, Pathan, Kot, K-O-T.
K, right.
K-O-T, Pathankot. So I moved in.
So when was that? What month would that be that you moved there?
That would be October.
And what happened when you got there?
Well, I put the core tactical headquarters into position. The Air Force were flying all the time on the alert because they didn't want to be taken by surprise, as they had been taken in 65 when the Pakistanis had actually attacked the airfields. And I was to ensure that these formations that arrived from far-off places like Secunderabad in South India or Jhansi in Central India were deployed operationally and communications established, which all I did. By the time the Corps Commander arrived in November, in the event the Pakistanis launched their preemptive in early December, but we were already in position to meet the so-called preemptive attack, and they were not able to in any way reach Pathankot. We had anticipated a situation which we had not anticipated in 65.
Now, who was the... Can you describe a bit your relationship? You were Chief of Staff to the when he arrived, the new commander. What was your relation with? Who was it first? And what was he like and what was your relation with him?
Well, the one who had left was a Lieutenant General Sitarawala, who had retired. I mean, he left on the day, the very night that I arrived.
No, I mean more the new one.
The new one was a Lieutenant General K.K. Singh. Initials are K.K. Singh. I, again, had known him from before. For a short while, he had been Chief of Staff in Headquarters Western Command when I was Brigadier General Staff. And he had held the appointment of Director of Military Operations, so he was privy to more information than we had because he'd been de-interrogating these East Pakistani defectors from the Pakistani Army.
And what was he like as a general? How competent in every way?
Well, he had a good eye for ground. He had, he was good with the pen in issuing orders. And he had been an Armoured Brigade commander in 1965 when his Armoured Brigade had got bogged down. But nevertheless, so he had experience of fighting the Pakistanis in 1965, and he had the latest intelligence by having been Director of Military Operations at Army Headquarters.
Did you manage to establish a successful relationship? It's a very key relationship between a general and his Chief of Staff. Was it a good relationship you established with him?
Well, it was a working relationship. One can't say it was entirely good, because sometimes I felt I was fighting Pakistan harder than he was.
In what way? What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, the point is he would go on to the defensive when I felt that we should be the offensive, and then he would go on to the offensive when I felt that we should be on the defensive. It was a question of approach, a question of tactics. I had to defer to his judgment. But nevertheless, I don't say that I was proved right every time, but I think I was proved right. I mean, shall we say, attacks. You see, what happens is, as Chief of Staff, you remain manning the headquarters. Whereas he went out every morning to visit the forward commanders. So he would approve plans for, shall we say, an attack, which in the event I would feel that should not have been approved. But it is a question of divergence which happens.
Well, do you think he was happy with you? You know, the other side of the coin?
Well, I mean, by circumstance, he was happy with me in as much as I was holding the fort for him while he was out. I mean, it was a short notice situation. I mean, in as much as when the actual Pakistani attack came in, he'd only been there a week. So it is difficult. If he had been the corps commander when I had reported, possibly things would have been more stable. But he arrived straight away, we confronted with war.
So can you take, I know it's difficult, but can you take us through some of what Pakistan did, and the sort of defensive manoeuvres? You'd moved up to cover Batangkot. Sorry, I can't pronounce it, mispronounce it there. But you'd moved up, and in a sense, this seems to have been a key thing, that you'd moved forward before they attacked, that you'd taken up defensive positions, unlike in 65.
We deployed one division, or rather two divisions. That is, not the whole division, but two brigades up. We deployed them between Pathankot and Jammu. And on this side, we deployed, that is, west of Pathankot, we deployed another division. So we had a defensive posture to ensure that this preemptive against Pathankot would not succeed.
Now, how far had they been able to dig in to take up defensive positions, or would the defensive positions already be there?
No, we had dug in because we were not making permanent defences in this area now. We had dug in to face a preemptive attack, and we were prepared for that.
Now, when did the Pakistan, they made an attack in December.
Pakistanis attacked night 3rd, 4th of December, But this time, we were on the ground guarding the international border. We were guarding the international border. So they were not able to gain any territory on the international border as they succeeded in 65. But the main thing is that the Air Force was on the alert. So therefore, there also they were not caught sitting on the ground.
Now, did the Pakistan attack make any headway at all, or was it beaten back at the frontier?
No, the Pakistanis were not able to intrude into Indian territory in one corps. They nearly succeeded in the other command, Southern Command. They nearly succeeded with an armored regiment, but again, by good fortune, God being on India's side, possibly, the tanks got bogged down in the sand, and the Air Force was able to attack them from the air. But they did not succeed on this side because we were ready for them.
Now, you said you disagreed with KK Singh on a couple of things: when to attack, when to defend. But when would these issues arise? Can you give us some examples?
No, because you see, the examples, I mean, as I say, that he would go on to visit formations in the morning. Naturally, as a commander, he had to be seen by the troops and be with them to take operational decisions. So one was, shall we say, an attack which he had approved, apparently, because after all, a place near Shakargarh. Now, in the event, I had an intuition that the Pakistanis were faking that they had withdrawn. They're faking that they had withdrawn. But three patrols that sent out came back and said the Pakistanis had withdrawn. I personally feel that they were just lying doggo. In the event, I was proved right. He had approved the attack. And the first company that crossed the minefield was scuppered. The tanks that tried to cross the minefield blew up on the minefield. So things like that. I personally felt that the that the intelligence on which he based the decision, I'm not suggesting his decision was wrong, but the intelligence given to him by the local formation on the ground was not correct. In the event, I'm sorry that it was. I was proved right, because this company of ours, of my regiment in fact, was captured by the Pakistanis.
Now what about sometimes when you thought it was right to attack rather than to stand back? Can you give an illustration of that?
Well, you see, the point is that when he was right, he was only acting on the orders of his superiors. That is, when they had ordered that we actually counterattacked. So from that point of view, he was governed by the orders of his superiors in relation to the nitty-gritty. After hostilities had started, it was the ebb and flow of battle, which was really the responsibility of the divisional commanders. It was out of his hands. But where he went forward in the morning to approve some local attacks, that is where I personally feel that he was swayed by the local commanders, whose analysis of the evidence was not valid. I'm not blaming him per se. I mean, the suggestion was made by these local commanders and he approved. For example, a brigadier would fly up in an AeroP aircraft and say the Pakistanis were withdrawing. And consequently, the attack would be approved by what the local commanders wanted. So that is well and good, but I did not agree that the Pakistanis were withdrawing. I mean, that is, it's an interpretation of intelligence. I'm not saying that, I'm not saying he was wrong, except that he was accepting intelligence that was not validated from the local people. So the fault was not his, basically. It was the fault of these rather too keen local people. Now, you see, everybody wants to be a kind of Montgomery, but the point is, well, Montgomery was only successful because Auchinleck had left the basis for him to succeed.
Now, did the Indian troops cross the Pakistan border in the counterattacks? Because
yes, we crossed the Pakistan border. We crossed the Pakistan border, but shall we say, not as much as we would have wanted. Shall we say, we may have only progressed 11 miles. That is largely on account of the minefields that Pakistan had laid. To some extent, we had knowledge of these minefields, but separately, though we had flail tanks, which we bought from the Soviet Union, flail T-55 tanks. But things being what they are, what happened was that people get too enthusiastic. So if you're going to have flail tanks, then you must establish an infantry bridgehead on the other side of the minefield to ensure the security of the tanks. But you get these go-bang people, hell for leather. And so therefore they send the flail tanks, thinking that the tanks will get through and that they will get through. But in the event they didn't, the flail tanks were knocked out in the minefield by the Pakistanis. It was a question that they forget the rationality of the tactics that they've been taught, and they seem to go for this go-bang theory, hell for leather, gung-ho.
So you hadn't been able to stop that from in the tactical training before, that people just forgot?
Well, the tactical training had been there. It was valid, but then these people had been carried off on the basis that if you attacked at a place, you see, the Pakistanis formations would have to have an inter-unit, inter-brigade, inter-division boundary. So somehow or the other, they had the idea that they would get through the so-called boundaries because they would not be coordinated.
But they were.
But they were.
How did the fighting progress then? What do you recall of it?
I think the Indian Army did well, and the Pakistanis that we captured said in their debriefing that they wish that they had junior commanders like those in the Indian Army, inasmuch as the junior officer in the Indian Army leads from the front, and there is no doubt, in my opinion, that the troops and their junior commanders, both from valor point of view or bravery point of view, are excellent. The problem always arises in all wars is the hierarchy.
Whereabouts would the problem come in the hierarchy? At what level?
Well, it came out at all levels from brigade commander upwards. I mean, some brigade commanders were good, some were not. Some divisional commanders were good, some were not. So the selection system, shall we say, to that extent, has failed. It wasn't, in terms of our selection boards, our selection system was not proved right in every case.
So it's the selection of senior officers that where the question was, or middling officers?
No, the middle officers are largely by seniority. It is where the selection boards come in for brigadiers upwards. That is where the weakness seems to lie. I think with our system of reporting and selection, we should have about 90% successful commanders. But in the event, we may have only about 70% successful commanders. You have to remove somebody after every spell of the war, pass over somebody, which should not be the case. We thought we had remedied it in 65, but we had not remedied it by 71.